Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Quick reminder that you can subscribe to us in a variety of ways, Google Play, Stitcher, Apple iTunes, and leaving a positive comment is not the worst life choice you actually could make. And we are joined by Kevin D. Williamson of National Review and long resume, which we'll just fill in. Thanks for joining me, Kevin.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Now, are you in Texas or someplace else right now?
I am currently in Texas. Okay. I was gone for a little while, but we are back home. So okay. It is sunshiny and warm and low taxes and a good day for motorcycling. So I'm in a reasonably good mood.
And you are, your title now is roving correspondent for National Review.
Has been for a long time. Yeah, I think Rich Lowry was not sure what to call me when I stopped doing editing work and just started writing full time. And then I moved out of New York, so I became roving correspondent. So I rove.
You know, I did extensive research to prepare for this podcast, by which I mean I downloaded your Wikipedia page.
As one does,
yes. And I'm not sure that most people, even people who are familiar with you, know that you once worked at the Mumbai-based Indian Express Group. I mean,
yeah, that's where I started after college.
Yeah. After college, where you got a BA in English literature, you got a degree in English literature, what the hell were you thinking?
Well, that's actually like a lot of things on Wikipedia, not entirely accurate.
Okay, I'm shocked.
Yeah. So it's funny, my Wikipedia page, well, first of all, I was shocked to learn that I had one some time ago. I look at it every now and then. It's been locked, apparently, because of vandalism, as they say. But I sent them a note about this, but no one has corrected it so far. I don't actually have a BA at all. So I was an English major at the University of Texas, but I left before completing my degree.
Yeah, no, see, I was an English literature major as well. And, of course, I had to spend years from people with, you know, having to answer people saying, you know, what were you thinking? Did you choose it because it was really specifically the most exquisitely non-practical degree you could possibly get, other than, say, flower arranging?
Yeah, you know, I disagree with that particular analysis. I think literature is a pretty good field of study, and increasingly, because so many of our jobs involve communication of various kinds, being a good writer is something that's professionally worthwhile, even if you're not a professional writer. You know, I joke with my wife sometimes, who is works in architecture and construction, that she's essentially a writer. You know, she writes reports and stuff, and that's what she does all day. So, no, I think that it's pretty worthwhile. If you want to talk about useless degrees, there's journalism, that should be just gotten rid of. There should be no such thing as a BA in journalism. Education is a pretty useless degree, in spite of Kamala Harris today trying to shunt $315 billion into the pockets of people who hold education degrees and such things. So there are some pretty useless degrees out there, but I think the liberal arts are worth studying and defending and keeping out there.
You know, I actually spent the day sitting at a journalism summit. I mean, you know, what fresh hell. And they're all sitting around, how do we recreate trust in journalism? And I actually was the guy that raised my hand
and said,
well, first of all, you understand it's like they just dropped a nuclear bomb on the city. And we're sitting around having a discussion on interior decorating here. I mean, this just did not happen.
You know, in about 20 years being a newspaper editor before I started just doing the opinion work that people mostly know me for now, I don't think I ever hired a person with a journalism degree. Mm-hmm. Not one, as far as I can tell. If I did, it was by mistake.
I never got a degree in journalism and have worked in journalism since then. There were some things I picked up on the side, but I'm wondering, what would you have spent 4 years studying that frankly, I mean, the most important skills being curiosity, just having critical thinking and knowing the English language. So I still defend the English literature degree. Okay, so I want to talk about a lot of things, including a piece you had a couple of days ago, because this one I think is an undercovered story. What happened to Jordan Peterson in Cambridge? Yeah. Jordan Peterson was apparently invited to be a visiting fellow, visiting professor. And at the very last minute, we're talking about the Cambridge University, rescinds the invitation and does so in the least classy way possible. By tweet.
Yeah, it was pretty low point for them, I think. But I mean, it was like we're talking about Oxford or something that counts. You know, she's Cambridge, but that's for Charlie Cook.
Kind of a state school in England, right?
Kind of, it's the University of Texas of England, basically. It's Dan Foster, who went to George Washington University, once described it as the Harvard of safety schools. And I thought that was a really great line.
That's good.
That's what I say with me. So, yeah, they uninvited Peterson from this visiting professorship after one of these, you know, usual familiar Twitter outrage mobs. And they said that he was not, quote unquote, representative of the student body, like he's running for Congress or something. You know, he's not there to represent people, much less undergraduates. He's there to teach them. You know, undergraduates, as Jonah Goldberg likes to put it, are at the bottom of the learning curve. There's no particular need to listen to them about anything. They're there to be instructed and to learn, not to be the dominant intellectual or cultural force on a campus, much less a campus of a purportedly pretty good school who's had some notable alumni over the years. This sort of thing is interesting to me for a lot of reasons. One, people always ask me about these stories because of that silly thing with The Atlantic. But one of the comments I read on this, which I thought was interesting and telling, was someone writing, you know, they shouldn't have done this in the first place, because by doing it and then uninviting him, it's kind of like, you know, they mentioned me in this, like Williamson being hired by The Atlantic and then let go. It just makes a martyr out of the person, which, okay, whatever. I don't really think that so much, you know. Jordan Peterson and me and other people like us, we're in the controversy business. That's just, you know, part of the nature of what we do. But the implicit argument there is we'd be better off if we just did this quietly and out of the public eye and just made sure that they were excluded from the intellectual conversation in a way that no one gets to talk about it. And, you know, that to me is a much more, you know, sinister and worrisome way of looking at things. And of course, that's how it mostly happens.
Right.
You know, I'll just go ahead and plug myself here. I have a book coming out on this subject called The Smallest Minority, coming out in the summer. And people like Jordan Peterson, people like me, people like us, you know, we are in this business. We have outlets. He's got an enormous web presence. And I read something, he makes like $15 million a month off of Patreon or something like that. I could be wrong about the numbers, but
I hope so.
Some, you know, absurd. It was a huge sum of money. I don't remember exactly what it was. But which, you know, fine, good for him. I'm glad he does. But, you know, we're not people who are excluded from the conversation. You know, if I get fired by The Atlantic, I write about it in The Wall Street Journal. Okay, life goes on. I think more people probably read The Wall Street Journal than read The Atlantic anyway. So that's, you know, it's not a huge thing. But there are lots and lots of people who don't have those sorts of outlets and those sorts of opportunities. And they also get excluded from the conversation, from public life in various kinds of ways. And some of those people are writers and thinkers and advocates of various kinds. And some of them are just ordinary, you know, schmucks who, you know, manage a Starbucks in Philadelphia. I used to have an office right next to that Starbucks there. And the one with the situation with the African-American guys who were asked to buy something if they wanted to use the bathroom. And, of course, Philadelphia, like lots of other cities in America, Houston comes to mind. Some others. Starbucks is essentially part, you know, psych ward, part homeless shelter. And it's got a coffee bar there, too, but that's, you know, it sort of does other things. Starbucks in New York, of course, are public toilets. That's the role they perform there. It's a public good that no one really appreciates Starbucks for providing. You know, these people, you know, people who are fast food managers, people in obscure, just ordinary jobs that don't have any necessarily public profile. You know, after that stupid thing with the Covington business, mm-hmm. you know, there's some lady who had a son who was there, who was standing in proximity to some kid who had a look on his face that somebody on Twitter didn't like. And there was an effort to get this woman fired from her job, even though she had nothing to do with this, except for the fact that she was the mother of a kid who was in the picture, who wasn't even the kid the picture was of, the one who, I guess, is suing a bunch of people now. So that kind of stuff is much more worrisome because, you know, those people don't have the kind of recourse that someone like Jordan Peterson does or someone like me does. And
so when you say people like us, you're referring to obviously having outlets. You're also referring to yourselves as heretics, thought criminals.
Sure, yeah. That's all a little romantic, I think.
Okay, but then how would you describe it? What you're a wordsmith. So you guys are what, renegades? I'm just, you'll throw it out.
People with unpopular opinions. I don't know. Actually, my opinions aren't even, for the most part, even all that unpopular.
Well, but they're unpopular in a certain way. They're right? They're in certain circles, obviously, toxically.
Well, you know, like it's okay. So different people. This is where, you know, Jordan Peterson and I are probably different in some ways. So Jordan Peterson really is disliked for his ideas. You know, the feminists are driven nuts by a lot of the things he says and the way he says them, and some other people are. For me, it's less about my beliefs and ideas, which are mostly pretty moderate, and to the extent that they're extreme libertarian. For me, it's really more about me. You know, it's, you know, personality, abrasiveness, the way I write, that kind of thing. So, you know, when the whole thing was going on at the Atlantic, it sort of ended up focusing on this thing with abortion. At least that was the conversation on social media and in, you know, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. But internally, it was, you know, if it wasn't that, it was my views about transsexualism. If it wasn't that, it was, you know, something else. It was something else. It was something else. And it became clear, you know, after a time, they were just sort of going down a list of things. And it wasn't about any of these particular views.
So this was a pretext, because you were clearly the, for lack of a better phrase, the heretic who'd been brought in. Like, why are you there? What is the point of bringing someone like
that? Well, and that was exactly it.
But isn't that the point of hiring you? Because you were the guy that was out there and throwing these, you know, these incredibly politically incorrect bombs. I wish I come up with a better phrase than that, but
yes, I just like that one too. But there was some of that, and I mean, what really happened there is, and I'll get into this a little bit more in the book and such, is it really didn't have anything to do with the exterior stuff that was going on, the Twitter stuff and the New York Times stuff and the Washington Post stuff. There were three or four people on staff who just didn't want me to work there. Uh-huh. And even though I wasn't going to work out of the office there or anything, the idea of being, you know, part of an organization that included me.
Well, what were they most afraid of and or did they find most objectionable?
Well, of course, I never really got the chance to find out because I never got the opportunity to speak to them. But these were mostly young people, you know, your stereotypical millennials who are terrified by difference and otherness and that sort of thing. You know, it wasn't – there's some pretty left-wing people on the staff of the Atlantic, as you might know,
sure,
but 20 years old and have been in journalism for a long time. I talked to these people about that. They're like, this is absurd. You know, of course, I think you're a monster, but there are a lot of monsters like you, and we should be publishing monsters too, obviously. So it's partly a generational thing. It's a matter of cultural style, that kind of thing. It had really very little to do with beliefs as such.
So there was a pro-monster caucus there, and then there was the group that felt that you were bringing in reactionary cooties.
Yeah, cooties, I think is how I recently put it, which, you know, is kind of where all this funny social tribalism goes. You know, right now in our politics, there's almost no real discussion of ideas, even ideology, that sort of thing. There are a lot of shibboleths, you know, intersectionality, colonialism, cultural Marxists, whatever, you know, stuff they say on the right that's the equivalent of that nonsense. But it's just us and them, white hats, black hats, cowboys and Indians, politics. Which is one of the reasons why our politics is so boring and so uninteresting right now.
Well, my guess is that most people who know you and have followed you understand that you have awfully thick skin. But let me ask you this, because I have been fired. I don't know, have you been fired before?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I mean, it is a thoroughly unpleasant experience. I mean, it is not something that people shrug off. So I guess the question that I'd have for you in this context is, you write with a sense of kind of fearlessness, like you're just all out of bleeps to give. But having gone through this, did this, you know, rock you back a little bit? Are you, I mean, let me get some sense of it. I mean, how has this changed the way you approach what you do?
Oh, I don't think it really has all that much. I mean, I'm a little more conscious of having multiple income streams. You know, you don't want to put all your financial eggs in one basket. So, you know, losing a job when you're a regular salaried person can be kind of disruptive. It was harder on my family, I think, than it was on me, because, as you said, I don't really care much about this kind of stuff. And in terms of, you know, traumatic things that have happened to me in my life, I don't think it's ever going to make it top 20. I mean, I've been fired from jobs before. I've been to jail, too. You know, jail's a lot worse. That's a lot, you know, more unpleasant. Other things that have happened in my, you know, personal life have been considerably more difficult than that. So some of the people around me, people in my family who weren't used to this kind of personal stuff, were a little freaked out by it. And for me, not so much. So has it changed anything about the way I write or what I do? Not really. I mean, it's annoying now that I get asked about this every time, you know, the New York Times hires somebody and people don't like her. I guess in the case of Sarah Jeong, I'm thinking of, and people ask me, you know, what do you think about this? I don't care actually all that much. Although in that case, I kind of admire the Times for sticking to their guns.
Well, you have become kind of the iconic figure of somebody who was hired and then fired because of what they said. So, you know, we'd actually mention the ostensible reason was I'm sorry now because I don't have it in front of me. Because I didn't know we were actually going to be discussing this. It was about what should happen to women who have abortions and should they be hanged. Your thoughts in retrospect, were you treated unfairly? Did people not understand this? Do you regret putting it that way?
No. You know, it was a dumb conversation that I was responding to, this idea that, well, if pro-lifers don't believe in treating this criminally like murder, then we shouldn't take them seriously in their beliefs. Well, okay, fine. If that's going to be your standard, then we can go along with that. You know, that's a conversation that can be had. As it turns out, I'm against capital punishment, right, which was right. Something that was generally left out of the conversation.
You made that actually quite clear. I listened to the YouTube videos at the time.
Oh, yeah. So one of the things that I've talked about, and this is there are two problems here. One is that people are dumb, and the other is that people are dishonest. So the dumb people you can't really do much about, and the dishonest people you can do even less about. So one of the things I've argued for a long time is that one of the things that is wrong with the way we do capital punishment, other than the fact that we typically do it for the wrong reasons and often to the wrong people, is the way we go about doing it, this kind of weird pseudo-medical clinical way of doing it. The fact that doctors are recruited into the willful taking of life is distasteful to me to start with. And I've often argued that if we're going to have capital punishment, then we should be really forthright and honest about what we're doing. We are taking a human life through violence for public purposes. And so from that point of view, it makes more sense to do something that looks a lot more like capital punishment. We talked about firing squads or hangings or various kinds of things they used to do. So if you add those two things together, you can just about get to the caricature, which is that, you know, Williamson wants to hang women who've had abortions, that sort of thing.
So this was a thought experiment you were doing. Is that correct?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I do think that abortion should be treated as homicide under the law. I think these are laws that should be changed, obviously. You can't go back and do it, you know, ex post facto or in an extrajudicial way, which is also something that I was often, you know, accused of, lynching, that sort of thing, which, of course, is just libelous nonsense. But, so I'm in favor of classifying abortion of most kinds as a homicide and punishing as such. Which is not really, from a worldwide point of view, all that radical of view. You know, I wrote a piece in the Washington Post about this, about the way that abortion is regulated in France, for instance. And I would like to have stricter regulations than that, but it seems like a good starting point. And the sort of basic operating assumptions you're working from are the same, irrespective of whether you decide to go this far or that far with the punishment.
You made an interesting point in passing that there have been other controversies, including at the New York Times, where they'd hired someone who had written some obviously highly controversial items, and yet they did not fire them. So why do you think the Times is standing by its writers, but the Atlantic decided to fire you?
Yeah. Some of this stuff is, again, as I said, part of it's about really me, you know, and my style of doing things. Part of it's class stuff. You know, there's a lot of stuff that you can get away with if you went to Harvard. You have that sort of affect, that way of writing, that way of presenting things. I remember having a conversation with Jeff Goldberg, who's the editor at The Atlantic, when I was talking about having been a bouncer at a establishment in college, which was not a reputable place, let's say, and things that I did while I was in school, and he thought I was joking until he figured out that I wasn't. So part of the problem was that my beat there was supposed to be essentially the stuff that I've written about, you know, white underclass poverty, drug abuse, opiates, that sort of thing. You know, the way he put it was a Moynihan Report for white people. That was kind of to be my theme. And the problem was that the Atlantic, you know, wanted someone to cover rednecks, and they messed up and hired one. And that was the real problem, you know. So having someone who was writing about that, and not to be like down on someone like David Frum, who I quite like in a lot of ways, and I find his writing useful on many subjects, but people who are the sort of people who work at the Atlantic are a lot more comfortable with someone like him or Ross Douthat or someone like that than they are with someone like me.
So you could write your memoir, A Redneck at the Atlantic.
That's a terrible title. But,
yeah. It is a terrible title. So who did you hear from?
By the way, it's going to be called The Gun Didn't Know I Was Loaded.
Good. So who did you hear from that you were surprised, and who did you not hear from that you were most disappointed by?
Well, what was interesting was that none of the people who wrote about me, the New York Times, the Washington Post, New Republic, none of them interviewed me, talked to me, made any attempt to communicate with me.
Really?
You know, I think there were 7 or 8 columns about me in the Times, something like that, which I've never written before, by the way. It's the one newspaper I've never had a piece in. So, it was strange to me, you know, in terms of just journalistic practice, that a situation like this, they wouldn't even attempt to ask a question of the person they were writing about. And some of it, of course, was really incredibly sloppy. Like the example I like to give, if you go back and read Paul Krugman's column about me on this.
Do I have to?
It's a paragraph about me, 7 paragraphs about Larry Kudlow, and then a closing sentence about me. And you can just look at it, and because I've been an editor for a long time, I know what happened was he wrote a column about Larry Kudlow because he hates Larry Kudlow and he thinks he's a crank. And he sent it in, and they said, we'd really like a column about Kevin Williamson instead because he's what's in the news today. And so he rewrote the lead, and he wrote a closing thing. But it's still a Larry Kudlow column in the middle. And there was a lot of that kind of stuff. Of just, you know, it was a slowish news week. There wasn't a lot going on. And media people like to write about intermedia squabbles and things like that. You know, we are obsessed by ourselves and our own little, you know, petty professional rivalries and that sort of thing.
So, Jeffrey Goldberg, what are you going to say about him in the book?
Oh, not a whole lot. I mean, the book isn't really very much about me. It's funny. I'd proposed this book sometime before that happened, and just nobody was really very interested in it. And then after I got fired, I basically sold the book by the time I got on the airplane to leave Washington. So it's funny how things work out that way. You know, Jeff is fine. I think he's a good editor. He's a good writer. I think The Atlantic is a great publication. I think he, you know, made the wrong decision in my case, and he made it for the wrong reasons. But, you know, if I boycotted every publication that had made a bad editorial decision, I would have nowhere to write, including the publications that I used to edit over the years, because we all make mistakes and such things. And I think he, you know, he made the wrong decision, but, you know, life goes on. He's mostly had a pretty good record.
You probably don't remember this, the last time that you and I met. We were in San Francisco at the National Review dinner, and I think that either your book, The Case Against Trump, had come out, or it wasn't. It had not yet come out. And I remember being very frustrated at the time. This would be in late 2015, thinking, you know, when is this book going to come out? Because it's going to be too late at some point. But you were, that was a forceful denunciation. So, you know, and now you work at National Review, which devoted an entire issue to conservatives against Trump. And let's just say there's been a little bit of an evolution on the part of some of your colleagues. Where are you at on this?
I haven't really changed my views on this. You know, Trump is what he is, and he's been in some ways better than expected, in some ways worse than expected. I think what's been probably the most surprising about Trump, for me anyway, is that in terms of actual day-to-day governance, the Trump administration is behaving more or less, with a few important exceptions, you know, the way a Ted Cruz administration might have, the way a Marco Rubio administration might have, the way a Jeb Bush administration might have, I think, anyway. You know, Republicans love tax cuts, and that's always been the top of the agenda. That's the thing that actually got done. The judges he's appointed, other people he's appointed to office have been, you know, mostly pretty conventional Republican types. It's not hard to imagine someone else appointing Betsy DeVos, Secretary of Education. I think that's a great choice. You know, Scott Pruitt was someone who had a very conventional Republican agenda. Unfortunately, he had a bit of petty venality there too, which made him ineffective. What's that?
A grifter streak.
Yeah, pretty wide one, as it turns out, in fact. But, you know, if you took his agenda and put it onto someone who was a bit more proper in their conduct of affairs, it would fit in with any other Republican administration, I think. So Trump, you know, Trump on Twitter, Trump after eight, when he, you know, gets upset and gets his rage on in the dark of night, which is funny because he doesn't drink. And normally when people like tweet crazy late at night, it's because they drink a lot, like some of our favorite talk radio hosts. But so that stuff he's been kind of worse at. I expected in some ways that once he got sworn in, he would go into the Oval Office and get a couple of briefings and go, holy crap, I'm president of the United States of America. I better get my act together. Right. And he's not really done any of that. He's still the, you know, adolescent, witless rage monkey we expected him to be. But in terms of the day-to-day operations of the administration, again, with a few exceptions, I think more or less what one would expect from a conventional Republican presidency. So in some ways better than expected, in some ways worse than expected. What's been most surprising to me about Trump is how quickly the Republican Party, the conservative movement, and many of its organs acclimated themselves to him, his style, his way of doing things.
And so thoroughly.
Yes, just really abjectly, in fact. Yeah. So down on their knees in a hurry, a lot of them. And that's been surprising and a little dispiriting. I mean, you know, you work in media, you work in activism, you know, you're used to some careerism, right? Mm-hmm. And some opportunism. That's part of the business. And we all got to make a living. And I understand that. That's fine. I wish I had Ann Coulter's book sales. I really do. I could use the money. But I saw a lot of that in places I didn't expect to see it. And in some places where I expected to see it, I was surprised to see that there wasn't anything else there.
You know, yeah, just a note on Ann Coulter. The ironic thing about Ann Coulter is that unlike so many people in MAGA world, she actually did seem to care about something.
Yeah.
As opposed to simply going along with everything. I'm not offering a defense of her. You know, one of the appeals, of course, of Trump has been, you mentioned the redneck America and the American carnage that he tapped into this sense of hopelessness and decline, which you've written about. So at one point, and you correct me if I'm mischaracterizing this, you know, pre The Atlantic, the big Kevin Williamson thing was your suggestion that maybe some of these small rural dying towns should hurry up and just die.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another one of those things that's been kind of willfully mischaracterized.
Okay. That's why I'm asking.
Partly, well, specifically by people at the Daily Caller and Breitbart, that thing that Andrew Breitbart's name is stuck to for all eternity, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I think he'd be embarrassed by it, but that's just me. So, yeah, I was engaged in this ongoing debate with Michael Brendan Daugherty, who now works for National Review and is a friend of mine. I like Michael a lot. He and I have a lot of similar interests and similar ways of looking at the world. And he was doing this kind of thought experiment with Garbutt, New York, which is a place I didn't really know very much about. Still don't know very much about. I've never been to Garbutt as far as I know. But he was like, you know, what about this guy who lives in a place like this who's, you know, he doesn't have any connections to things like finance or to technology. His prospects aren't very good. What does the Republican Party have to say to him? And what I've often said is, people, if you're living in a place where there's not a lot of opportunity, the best thing you can do is move and go where there is some. I've had 27 home addresses, something like that, since I finished high school. And so there was some question about, from Michael, doesn't the community itself have any value? This town has been there for a long time, and it's got institutions and people who belong there and neighborliness and all this stuff. And those things are of course, important. I started kind of looking into the town, which existed because of the gypsum business. And there was an essay written about Garbutt talking about its decline and, you know, how the, you know, hotels and restaurants had gone away and there weren't any businesses there anymore. And as a shell of its former self, this is written in 1908. Because the gypsum business went down pretty quickly and it had a little bit of a renaissance later when they started using it for wallboard and stuff like that. And then Garbutt ended up becoming part of this, you know, vast kind of greater East Coast urban conglomeration. So my argument about these places, though, is that if they really don't offer you anything, if there's nothing there for you but despair and addiction and dysfunctional families and no job opportunities and all the rest of it, then, yeah, leave. And if the communities die, they die. There hasn't been a Garbutt there since the beginning of time. There's no existential necessity that Garbutt should exist. It came into existence for specific economic reasons. It may go out of existence for specific economic reasons. And
okay, that doesn't sound the way you put it. That doesn't sound that radical. In fact, basically, you know, it talks about the destructive force of economic change. So how was it mischaracterized? What did people say you were saying?
Oh, Kevin wants the white working class to die.
Okay, that's what I was
So they can be replaced by, well, so the respectable conservatives would say so they can be replaced by Mexicans, and the unrespectable conservatives would say by Jews. Yeah, they are there are people out there who are looking for something to be outraged about because there's a lot of money in outrage. You know, you listen to talk radio, you watch the cable news stuff, and it's always the same plot line over and over and over. We're the good, pure people, and we've been stabbed in the back by the establishment, by these evil, scheming elites. And if it weren't for that plot line, you know, Sean Hannity would have nothing to talk about all day. And, you know, Tucker Carlson, God bless him, good guy, I like him a lot, but he'd have nothing to talk about all day without this BS, you know, plot line. And the thing about this that, you know, someone like me particularly finds galling is, you know, Tucker's a good example of this. I think that, you know, he takes this position of speaking for the, you know, the working class, the people who have been disadvantaged by globalization and all that sort of stuff. He didn't know the first thing about it. You know, he's from a billionaire family. He was his mother was the heir to the Swanson's frozen food fortune. You know, he didn't grow up eating TV dinners. He grew up cashing checks. You know, these people who are the self-appointed tribunes of the plebs, speaking on behalf of interests they don't understand, for people they don't know, communities they've never been into, don't know anything about. I find that sort of thing really aggravating. And
being a redneck yourself.
Well, yeah, being from this sort of background, certainly.
You can't be a redneck and an elitist.
Well, sure you can. And I like to think I'm those things. You are where you are and you come from where you come from. In terms of elitism, I never get that. I hear it people with $200 million like Sean Hannity or someone like that. I don't know what he's worth, but some absurd amount of money. And they use this term elitist like it's a it's the ultimate insult and we're supposed to be embarrassed by it. And people say, you know, Kevin, I think you're an elitist. And I say, I work at National Review. It was a magazine founded by a guy who kept a harpsichord on his yacht. I'm not really exactly stung by charges of elitism. Yeah, I'm an elitist. I think that we should listen to smart people more than we listen to people who aren't smart.
So it's almost it's a code word, though, isn't it? I mean, when you talk about it, I mean, when somebody like Sean Hannity throws it around, he's trying to say something else, isn't he? He's obviously not talking about
You know, Orwell writing about fascism, the word fascist simply means I hate you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hate this guy. That's all fascism means. That's all elitism means anymore. And in some context, it means I work in the media and this other person works in the media. And this person has a bigger audience or, a more fruitful career than I've had.
You know, you mentioned the outrage industry, but it's also that narrative of that you are a victim and they are coming for you. And that's why you need to follow me, because there's always somebody else to blame for your problems. And there's always somebody else who is going to take your job, your women, whatever. And it is interesting watching the conservative movement really embrace that kind of victimist narrative.
Yeah. For a long time, there was a thing on the right in the 80s. They called the two Santa Claus theory. And this had to do with the political value of tax cuts. You know, part of the Laffer analysis of tax cuts was economic, but a lot of it was just political. And it's that the left comes along and they want to give you this. They want to give you that. They've got all sorts of benefits and goodies they want to give away. What does the right have? Well, the right doesn't want to give stuff away. but we can do tax cuts, right? So tax cuts are something we can give away that's consistent with our ideology. And we're really, really good at that. In fact, we got so good at it that it stopped being a useful political issue because so few people now directly pay federal income taxes anyway. And, you know, it was the thing that got Mitt Romney chased out of polite society for, you know, noticing that the numbers are what the numbers are on that particular issue. And I think the victimization rhetoric has been roughly the same thing where, you know, we've looked at the left getting a lot of mileage out of that, where you get, you know, white women who are Ivy League college professors in jobs they literally can't be fired from, that pay, you know, a six-figure salary and the first figure is not a one. And they go out and talk about how, you know, they're victims of this, victims of that. And so give me, you know, more power, more benefits, more security, more standing. And conservatives have looked at that over the years and said, damn, we've got to get us some of that. And they've finally come up with a way of doing it, which is that you're a victim, and the person you're a victim of, the parties you're a victim of, have to be people who aren't influential in American politics, who don't vote or make campaign donations, at least very often. So we've got the Chinese, and we've got the illegal immigrants in Mexico more generally, and then these shadowy transnational elites, which has been part of American political discourse from, you know, Henry Ford through George Wallace and Ross Perot and now Trump. And I think that's one of the things we misunderstand about Trump and the Trump movement. It's the same energy, people, and ideas as Perot. He just had the intelligence to run the Perot campaign inside the Republican Party instead of in a half-assed third party. It's essentially the same energy as the Wallace campaign, although with a little bit less of a racial angle, I think. Racial politics just aren't what they used to be in the United States. So that kind of
Buchanan, you know,
populism's always been there. Yeah, the Buchanan movement, certainly. Yeah.
And, you know, it's always been around, but it's always been a recessive gene. You know, you mentioned the, you know, shadowy cosmopolitan international elites. I mean, look, that's always been there. But I will admit that I was taken by surprise in 2015, 2016, seeing these folks come out of the shadows because I didn't think they were around anymore, or certainly not in the numbers of the influence they are. And that's been one of the disconcerting things for me.
Yeah, I guess it was less surprising for me just and maybe that has to do with just, you know, personal experience and, you know, where I'm from, the community I come from, what my family's like, that sort of thing. So these were ideas that I've been hearing, you know, all my life that had a great deal of currency with people, Democrats and Republicans both, especially in the Southwest, you know, the people who are very anti-trade, who are very skeptical of international institutions and international accords, who are very, very skeptical of immigration, both legal and illegal, who take a very zero-sum view of things. This isn't something that's been exclusively conservative, I think, by any stretch of the imagination. You know, labor union guys have made this center of their politics for a long, long time. And so if you're in certain kinds of, you know, I don't want to be that guy who goes on about, you're at a Georgetown cocktail party. By the way, I was at a Georgetown cocktail party the other day. It was the first one I've been to in like years and years and years. I think I've been to two in my life. But it was great because Bill Kristol was there. And I was like, wow.
Of course Bill Kristol was there.
Caricature comes to life. I am at a Georgetown cocktail party having a canapé with Bill Kristol. So that's all they need to know about you, right? And if you live in New York, you live in Washington, you live on the East Coast, big cities, or even places like Austin where you're in a culture that's very much like that, you don't come into contact with certain kinds of people as much as you do if you grow up in, say, Lubbock, Texas, and you know, you've got family there still and you spend time in those sorts of places, or if you do what I do, which is you spend a lot of time driving around places like Eastern Kentucky and Oklahoma and the interior of California and writing about what's going on in those places. And if you've got that experience, you hear a lot more of this stuff. And so the Trump stuff wasn't as surprising to me. I mean, I was surprised he won.
Yeah.
But I was surprised in the sense that statistically unlikely things are unlikely, but they're not impossible. And this was a statistically unlikely thing. But unlikely things happen from time to time.
So, Kevin Williamson, thanks for joining me. By the way, what is the name of your book? When does it come out?
It's called The Smallest Minority, and it will be published on July 23rd.
Available for pre-order?
Yes, please do. Go to Amazon and order it up.
Kevin, thanks for spending time with me. I appreciate it very, very much.
My pleasure.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.